Delta Force and SEAL Team 6 put him on autopilot. Despite the adrenaline and physiological stress, he exhaled, then smoothly pulled the trigger until the suppressed weapon coughed. But he was not rewarded with seeing the impact. An Al-Qaeda fighter charged him from his right side to counterflank the Americans, firing wildly. John shot his assailant from a few feet away, stopping him and knocking the man over. Before he could pick another target, he was suddenly slammed in the torso and knocked backward.
"Where'd that come from?"
he yelled to Slab over the sound of the machine gun. But he never heard the answer, toppling back and onto his side. His world went dark. Slab heard the shout but didn't respond. He saw Chapman 10 feet away, the NVG's green glow illuminating his face and his laser pointing against a tree, rising and falling with his breathing. The controller's legs were crumpled beneath him, but he was alive. The mountain was exploding around Slab and his two remaining fire teams. To his left, the first man of Fire Team 1 arrived, with the other SEAL hot on his heels. The latter had their only crew-served firepower, an M60, and he scuttled around behind his teammate with the rock masking him, so he and Slab could huddle. Slab looked over at Chappie, but the laser, while still on, didn't appear to be moving, and he concluded the combat controller must be dead. He was now down two men. "Get on top of the rock and fire point-blank in the bunker," he told his 60 gunner. Slab needed to put an end to Bunker 2 quickly if they were to survive. "Roger that," replied the other, who climbed the half-dozen feet to the top and began firing from a knee. When he couldn't get a good enough angle into the bunker, he stood up and began pouring sustained fire into the position. As he did, Slab moved to the other Fire Team 1 member in preparation for a sweep to the left to finish off the resistance when a frag grenade, thrown from the bunker in the face of the 60 gunner's withering fire, exploded near the SEAL's feet. It was followed by another determined fighter exposing himself to return the point-blank barrage with his AK-47, striking the 60 gunner's thighs. The SEAL rolled off the rock, calling out, "I'm hit!" as he collapsed at Slab's feet. The two SEALs held another rapid discussion while the first member of Fire Team 1 continued to fire from the left side of the rock. At least the enemy wasn't charging them. Slab had no idea of the numbers of Al-Qaeda and Chechens on the mountain. But if they rallied in force, the SEALs, now without Chapman's expertise in walking fire up against their own positions, would be wiped out. 2.5 men behind a lone rock, only marginally supported from below by a single two-man fire team without heavy weapons, were powerless to stop a rush.
"Are you hitting the chest?"
he asked.
"No, I'm hitting the legs."
That was good.
"Can you move?"
"Yeah." They'd been on the mountain now for 8 minutes, with two more casualties, a dwindling supply of ammo, and no better command of the terrain than when they'd landed. Slab had used up his entire supply of 40mm grenades and had discarded his M203 in the snow, leaving him only his sniper rifle. He made his decision. They were retreating. Now. The three SEALs wasted no time moving off the summit and rapidly passed Bunker 1. The first Fire Team 1 SEAL had also been shot during the firefight with a grazing wound to the knee. In their rush to retreat, no one checked Chapman's condition, though only Slab knew at the time that Chappie had been shot. A Predator pilot leaned back in the chair of his cockpit inside an air-conditioned trailer 1,500 miles in a time zone away, silently watching the SEALs and Chapman's battle for life. On his next pass, while the SEALs withdrew, the nameless pilot dropped the Predator 1,000 feet to get a better view of the action. Though he didn't know their names, he watched the SEALs passing below the bunker. On his screen, Chapman's still warm body very clearly showed under the bonsai tree, and, slightly cooler, Robert's body lay along the SEAL's path. The pilot watched the SEALs as they huddled below Bunker 1. In defilade below the bunker, and 10 feet from the stricken controller, they continued to return fire. Downslope, Fire Team 2 did the same, but the route from the outcrop to their current location did not pass Chapman. The most likely event in the dark is that Slab passed Robert's body, which was between Bunker 1 and the outcrop, but not above the bunker. Chapman, in his last engagement before going down, was above Bunker 1, where he had engaged the flanking Al-Qaeda. Footnote. This scenario resolves several conflicting theories put forth in other accounts and after-action reports, and Slab's own statements. Slab remains confident he checked a body. However, Slab's own testimony in various interviews, historical recordings, and witness statements is not consistent on the matter, some versions contradicting others. 15 years later, in the course of the Air Force's Medal of Honor investigation, the five surviving SEALs would change their stories further, countering their original witness statements widely circulated and used in awarding Chapman's Air Force Cross and confounding the Air Force's efforts. Later, Slab would claim to have moved across the controller's feet and wondered why he didn't react if he was alive. But he never stopped to check a pulse or otherwise inspect the fallen man, who in reality was almost certainly Roberts. For the moment, believing Chapman dead, Slab was concerned only with their survival. They were still a divided force, and unless they consolidated and moved off the mountain, they'd all end up like Chapman, who had bought them initial relief and salvation in the early part of the battle. They spent the next 4 minutes taking stock of their condition, ammo count, and situation, discussing the matters while still engaging the enemy from below the bunker. When it was time, Slab tossed a smoke grenade to mask their retreat, and they left the summit for the final time just after 0510. The 60 gunner, with his damaged legs, went first as the three began to scramble and slide toward the lower fire team. The last to leave the position, Slab was suddenly confronted with a donkey on the far side of Bunker 1. He pumped 2 rounds into it as it sat in the snow, believing it would help to mask their retreat. The three stopped at the edge of a cliff and waited for Fire Team 2 to join them. The lower fire team was across an open saddle where it extended out onto a ridge, projecting out to a rock fin at the end. Throughout the engagement, 2 Al-Qaeda fighters had traversed the ridge, encroaching and then withdrawing from the fire team, seemingly torn between closing with the enemy in the darkness and fearing the consequences if they did. Fire Team 2 made the move to consolidate with the others across the nearly 50-meter open saddle. As they ran, pursued by the PKM from Bunker 2, one of the SEALs shouted in pain and fell. He'd been hit in the right ankle, the round nearly severing the SEAL's foot from his leg. His teammate half-supported, half-dragged him the remaining distance. When they joined the other 3 survivors, one of the SEALs took a head count. Coming up one short, he asked, "Where's Chappie?"
"He's dead," Slab told him.
Slab again took stock of his diminishing team. 2 dead, 3 injured, 2 of them seriously. The Fire Team 2 SEAL who'd been shot was bleeding heavily and in great pain. They were off this rock. There was only one direction to go, down. But the terrain below was a nearly vertical, snow-covered slope, interrupted only by straight ledge drops of unknown height. If they could gain enough distance, Slab could perhaps get on the radio and have Grim 3-2 destroy the entire summit. He couldn't know with absolute certainty, but Roberts had to be dead. And as for Chappie, Slab believed him to be dead too. Blowing the mountaintop would not change that fact. Footnote. Of Chapman's initial actions ahead of all the SEALs, and in the face of an unknown and superior positioned enemy, Slab would state unequivocally in his testimony, "I know if John hadn't engaged the first enemy position, it would have surely killed us all before we reached cover." Adding, "John died, saving us from the enemy fire, which was effective from 3 sides when he was killed." Concluding with, "I feel privileged, honored to have known him and have called him my friend. John deserves the highest medal we can get for him. These words, while expressing gratitude for the combat controller's bravery and audacity, would prove challenging to live by for some of Slab's higher-ups at SEAL Team 6 in the years to come. In Bunker 2, the Chechens continued to engage. Despite the smoke, the SEALs were now more exposed to incoming fire and vulnerable in the morning twilight. For men without NVGs, the pre-dawn broadcast movement and the American weapons were easily identified, if not by their muzzle flashes and disciplined fire rates, then by the report of their bullets leaving the barrel. U.S. 7.62 and 5.56 ammunition, the only two rounds the SEALs were using, have a distinct sound all combat veterans know well. The same is true of the Eastern Bloc 7.62 coupled with the AK-47. There is no mistaking the weapon. Whether or not the Chechens and Uzbeks knew how much damage they had inflicted on their enemies, or the limited number of Americans they fought, will never be known. What was clear was their willingness to engage in a fight. At this point in the battle, it was academic for the SEALs. They'd now huddled below Chapman for over 5 minutes and started down the cliff 13 minutes after they'd stepped off the helicopter's ramp. The first to move created a snow slide down the vertical. The rest followed. The snow may have saved their lives as surely as Chapman had. The steepness allowed the two severely wounded SEALs to slide and drag themselves without having to stand erect. Even the Predator video showed the snow slides preceding the men down the mountain, gaining speed as they traveled. When the Americans stopped firing at Bunker 2, it emboldened the now three Al-Qaeda fighters on the fin above them. Barely a minute after the SEALs began their sliding retreat, two of the Muslim brothers began to move again. No longer taking fire, the two walked to overlook the Americans at the far end of the fin, where it terminated in a rocky outcrop and sheer 50-foot drop. The Americans could be clearly seen sliding down the slope, presenting the perfect opportunity to kill them all. Under the bonsai-shaped tree above Bunker 1, Chapman's body lay inert. To all appearances, he was dead. Chapter 20. March 4th. Approximately 0300 hours. While the gunships and CCT in the Shahi Kot were making short work of Al-Qaeda, Staff Sergeant Gabe Brown was sound asleep in his rack at Bagram Airfield when he was shaken by the shoulder. Footnote. The following excerpt demonstrates the international composition of the enemy's forces. With the first signs of night, AC-130 planes arrived that carried machine guns similar in caliber to the Dishka 12.7mm, although they were also able to fire missiles, and had night vision, which would allow vision for a distance of up to 6 kilometers away. We could do nothing but raise our hands and pray to Allah. Our brothers had dispersed and were motionlessly positioned in trenches, for the enemy's weapons could detect any movement. Since the brothers had been engaged in battle until night, the planes found us to be easy night targets, and on that night, about 20 Mujahideen were killed by their planes. 7 of them were Arabs, 2 from Morocco, 1 from Syria, 1 from Somalia, 1 from the Arabian Peninsula, 1 from Jordan, and 1 from Egypt. From the depths of a sound sleep, Gabe couldn't comprehend who it was, merely a voice as though from far away. "They need you." Bleary-eyed, he shook off the cobwebs, tumbled into a semblance of uniform, and stumbled to the JOC. Another false alarm, no doubt. He'd never had a combat search and rescue notification turn out to be anything other than false. The 29-year-old combat controller had been in Afghanistan for only a couple weeks and felt lucky to be in country at all. To be on alert with TF-160 for CSAR, along with two PJs, team leader Kerry Miller and Jason Cunningham, who, like Gabe, was part of a pickup game of augmentees for other assignments for roles such as this, was good fortune indeed. That's not to say that combat search and rescue duty provided real opportunities. It was known among the CCT that while CSAR was potentially stimulating, the odds of a real crash in which you engaged the enemy and killed them with airstrikes while saving fellow Americans were slim. The last time Special Tactics had conducted a CSAR of any note was in Somalia in 1993, during the battle infamously known as Black Hawk Down. There, the 24STS package of two PJs and a CCT saved the lives of multiple Rangers and Delta Force operators over the grueling and deadly 18-hour battle. Gabe had pulled CSAR enough to know these things. The CSAR package and its associated Quick Reaction Force, QRF, of Rangers were pre-staged at Bagram Airfield for contingencies, on alert 24 hours a day. Comprising a Ranger platoon and a three-man Air Force Special Tactics team tailored to CSAR, it had one combat controller and two PJs. Their job was to fly into the worst fight or crash site and take control, providing relief, fire support, and recovery all in one package. The Rangers provided the relief, the CCT, the fire support, and the PJs the recovery. A quietly determined and confident man, Gabe is stocky at 5'9", thick in every direction, with a full head of auburn hair and calm features. He smiles often, with or without a beer in hand. He's not built like the typical image of a controller, but if told he needed to walk from the Yukon Territory to Hudson Bay, unsupported and starting tomorrow morning, he would shrug his shoulders as if to say, "Yeah, okay," pack a rucksack, and set off without so much as a question, to reappear 4 months later on the other side of the continent looking for a beer. In the fall of 2001, 7 years into his combat control career, he was midway through what he considered an administrative assignment, supporting the C-130 pilot school at Little Rock AFB in Arkansas. He'd taken the assignment to focus on his goal of finishing a degree, an endeavor he was diligently pursuing along with raising a young family. Unlike some of his contemporaries, he hadn't chosen to pursue an assignment at the 2-4. I was never one of those guys that was setting myself up for the 2-4, doing extra workouts at night, focusing on operational academic excellence. I'd rather drink a beer in the evening. But when the 9/11 terror strikes hit, he felt left out in the backwater eddy of Arkansas, so he volunteered to deploy with the 23rd STS out of Hurlburt Field, Florida. His big break came when he joined Kerry Miller's CSAR team in Afghanistan in February of 2002. He liked Kerry, a giant of a man at 6'4", with a mop of brown hair, who had a down-to-earth personality and didn't mind bending a few rules. He was well-respected throughout the special tactics community, and particularly at the 2-4, for his calm demeanor and expertise with trauma medicine. The second PJ, Jason Cunningham, was a 26-year-old golden boy on a thin 5'11 frame, boyish smile and talkative personality. As a senior airman, he was the lowest ranking and least experienced of the three-man team. Like Gabe, he had a young family. Two little girls waited at home with his wife, Teresa, Kyla, age 4, and Hannah, barely 1. He and Gabe talked about family a lot together. When Gabe arrived at the JOC, he was told, "There's a missing aircrew member down south, beginning self-SAR." That was all the information they had. Self-SAR indicated the individual was separated from the rest of his crew and friendly forces, but didn't add any details of value to the combat controller. It also didn't make a great deal of sense. I didn't think much of it, likely just another spin-up for no reason, and I expected to go back to bed. However, on the flight line where the helicopters were staged, Gabe, Kerry, and Jason ran into a sister CSAR team from the 2-4, CCT Greg Pittman, PJ Scott Duffman, and another PJ. Greg's team was just coming off another mission. All highly experienced in their jobs, the two CCT and four PJs huddled to discuss which team would take the now very real mission. Of the six men standing on the ramp in Bagram on that frigid March morning, bristling with gear and weapons in the scant illumination, two would die in Afghanistan. One killed in the next few hours, the other less than 4 years later. On the ramp, with the MH-47 blade spinning, things were developing fast. A Ranger QRF was also assigned to the mission. Consisting of a dozen young Rangers and led by Captain Nate Self, they were clearly going to launch. The question, which package of CCT and PJ experts in trauma medicine, aircraft recovery, and close air support was going to take the mission? Greg Pittman and Scott Duffman were just coming off a mission. I think it was airborne support for the Anaconda insertions for AFO. Anyway, Carrie, as a 2-4 member and our team leader, ended up having a bit of a debate with them, but must have come out on top because he said to Gabe and Jason, "We're going." And that was it. So I went and found the Rangers and their team leader, Captain Self, who I didn't know, to sort out fires, recalls Gabe. Footnote. The young Ranger officer had an embedded Air Force tactical air control party, but when Gabe and Self talked, the Ranger told him, "Your fires," thus settling any confusion as to who would be controlling airstrikes once the team hit the ground. Furious activity swirled around the designated CSAR helicopter, another TF-160 MH-47E, callsign Razor 01, piloted by Chief Warrant Officer Greg Calvert, the pilot who'd flown down to swap out the helo with the runaway engine at Gardez just an hour before, and who was therefore somewhat familiar with the area. Furthermore, Calvert and the other pilots, the CSAR bird flew with three, one riding jump seat at the rear of the cockpit, had practiced rescue scenarios with the 2-4 teams and other forces in preparation for just such a crisis. Gabe, Jason, and Carrie dashed for their nearby gear and returned to the spinning rotors of Razor 01, clambering aboard along with the Rangers. Gabe recalls, "We launched without any additional information. On the hour flight toward Shahi Kat, Self passed around a grease board with some coordinates on it, which didn't mean shit to me. Might as well put me in space and point at the Earth for all the good it would do. He'd have to go in blind." For Calvert, the situation was frustrating. He may not have known the details, but he certainly knew the men flying with him. In the cockpit, they discussed the grid coordinates they'd received with the sketchy information on the ground situation. "We could see on the moving map that the objective was the pinnacle of a tall mountain we had been flying around, twice, I believe. There was some confusion as to whether this was the place. We still had the idea the isolated person and Razor 03 may have been co-located, or close. The other two pilots and I did discuss that something just did not feel right, and the fact that we all had that hair on the back of my neck standing up feeling." Don, the most senior pilot, riding in the jump seat, to lighten the mood, said it was just his fingers on the back of my neck. But the air crew's instincts were telling them more than TF-11 could. Things were happening on Taker Gar, and none of the pilots, or QRF, whirling their way to the mountain, knew what the outcome was going to be. Chapter 21. March 4th. Approximately 05:15 hours. John Chapman must have become aware of himself, gradually and painfully. He was lying in the snow, crumpled on top of his own legs. He wasn't sure what had happened, not exactly. It was dark, but his NVGs were still on. The night sky was clear and the air bitterly cold. Above him was a lone tree with a thick trunk extending perhaps 10 feet toward the heavens before spreading out into a thick crown, like a supersized Japanese bonsai tree. Though, arboreal aesthetics were immaterial. He needed to figure out what had happened, and he couldn't ignore the pain. A cursory check would reveal 2 gunshot wounds in his torso. He ached, not only from the impact of the AK-47 bullets to his body, which had shocked the tissue around their points of entry, leaving already dying flesh surrounding the holes, but also from the ungodly pain in his abdomen. One hole was just above his navel, on the right side. The other bullet had entered just below the ribs on the same side. There was blood on his uniform, sticky and dark in the night where the bullets had penetrated. The pain was intense. Was he bleeding internally? It would be difficult to say what damage lay beneath his uniform. Since none of the team had worn body armor, the rounds tore through his tissue like a hot knife stabbed into a pat of butter. His cursory self-inspection complete, John needed to focus on his situation. A quick scan revealed his surroundings. Next to him was the trench from which the Al-Qaeda fighters had attacked him as he'd charged uphill. Two bodies lay dark and lifeless in its recesses. Nearby was the body of another fighter, the man who'd shot him. At least he was dead. To his left was the large rock outcropping where he'd last seen Slab. Where the hell were Slab and the others? Were they dead? Or had they left him for dead? Fuck. Gunfire from Bunker 2 above brought the situation into instant focus. The PKM was firing, but not at him. Answering fire from far behind and below, easily identifiable, answered his SEAL question. They were down there somewhere, not far, but a lifetime away for a wounded man. He couldn't see them, but maybe he could reach them on his Zembiter. He fought through the pain as his frozen fingers fumbled with the radio on his chest. He was no longer sweating. Shock and the cold were attacking his capabilities, and the pain was intense. His watch read a bit past 0520, still dark, though morning twilight would illuminate the mountain to the unaided eye in another 30 minutes. He needed help immediately, or the Chechens and Uzbeks would surely overrun him in the daylight, if he lived that long. Switching from the fire control frequency he'd preset for airstrikes before they left Gardez, he dialed it to a line-of-sight UHF battlefield common frequency. Airstrikes were not what he needed at this moment. He didn't know where Slab and his team were, or how many might still be alive, although clearly they weren't on the summit any longer. But there were other combat controllers in the vicinity, Jay and Andy in particular, and all CCT viewed Battlefield Common as their private comms freak, even if that wasn't expressly what the frequency was for. "Any station, any station. This is Mako 30 Charlie." And he waited alone in the dark. It's nearly impossible for the average human to understand the implications of true abandonment. The worst thing for a soldier is to be left behind on the battlefield. And that is exactly what happened to John. At this point, John Chapman was essentially a grunt, the basic individual battlefield element in combat. The distilled essence is kill or be killed. And his extensive specialized training, while not negated, was much marginalized. All the men on the mountain, Al-Qaeda, SEALs, himself, were simply soldiers in the classical sense, fighting as soldiers have always done, in sweat, in cold, in fear, and in determination. The overriding imperative was their commitment to their comrades they lived and fought alongside. And the one absolute of combat among soldiers is, never leave a comrade behind or to the enemy. Heroics, courage, cowardice, these things can vary even within an individual, depending on the circumstances and the day. It's a concept difficult for civilians to understand. To them, a soldier soldiers on, rising to an occasion to perform some act of heroism when called for. But the truth for men in combat is the opposite. Courage is nothing but the necessity of action when a comrade is in trouble. To not act is cowardice, the opposite of the requirement to save one's brothers. Invariably, those awarded medals for courageous acts on the battlefield view their actions as just doing my duty. They would have done the same for me. This is most acute in the face of a friend under fire and threat of capture by the enemy. Yet now, the unbreakable rule had been broken. For men who are willing to fight and contend with the fear of capture by an enemy whose objective is to torture and then kill their captives, Abandonment by their brothers is tantamount to a mother who abandons her child. It strains credulity. To the individual, child, or soldier, this new reality comes crashing through the mind's barriers. This can't be happening. One can only imagine the impact on Chapman when the realization of abandonment hit home. 3 kilometers away, Jay Hill also sat freezing on a 10,000-foot peak, with his friend and Delta team leader, Chris. Despite the cold, Jay was busy. Extremely busy. On his mountaintop OP, his radios were arrayed around him, each within grasp. Now entering their 4th nonstop day observing Al-Qaeda positions, he'd been up for the last 72 hours straight. No sleep and the constant cold were a fierce combination in an endless struggle deep inside enemy territory. Earlier in the night, they were shocked to watch as Mako 3-0 made its undeclared insertion attempt directly onto Taker Gar. From my position, I had good visibility on their summit. We were surprised they went in there. We didn't know beforehand. It was busy at our location, too. We were getting mortared, but I just laid down from being up for 3 days straight. When the mortars came in, the Delta guys picked up my radio and were talking to a flight of B-52s who were checking in. I woke up and heard them and told them, "Hey guys, you gotta get off the radio. Let me do that. That's my job. You guys keep eyes on and provide security." They were using the laser rangefinder to coordinate, but had the wrong coordinates for strikes, so I got up and worked it. But I don't want to give the wrong impression. It was a team effort. I needed to double-check coordinates for the calculus, then plot it on the map. We were using Falcon View on a toughbook at the time and a 1-24 map to cross-reference. It was all pretty dicey compared to how we do it now. 2 hours later, Juliet team had been stunned to watch a second MH-47 fly onto Taker Gar, a location Juliet had passed during their infill, choosing instead their current peak, nearly as high but unoccupied. We'd pulled up to that spot and realized it was a great location to observe the valley. We were gonna use it, but it's got bad dudes all over it. That night on Taker Gar, you could see the helos going in and see flashes of gunfire, RPGs. I could see the bonsai tree, but not the base of it. Jay was working on the net, talking to Andy and hoteling, sharing information and air assets, when he heard Chapman call the first time. He didn't know where Chapman was calling from, but knew it was his fellow 24STS teammate. He recognized Chappie's voice. And no one else used the Charlie suffix, so it wasn't the seals of Mako 3-0. "Mako 3-0 Charlie, this is Yankee Uniform 3, go ahead." YU-3 was Jay's call sign on J-Team, one of the few CCT call signs not to use a C suffix. He was rewarded only with static. With no response from Chapman, Jay returned his attention to his own tasks. Over the air a few minutes later, it came again. "Any station, Mako 3-0 Charlie. Go ahead, 3-0 Charlie." Nothing but static. Jay checked his radio in the dark, something he could do by feel. It was configured correctly. Chapman was calling on a battlefield common UHF frequency, one used for non-fire control or emergencies to communicate among friendly USSOF. Of the transmissions, Jay said, his voice was... He was struggling to get words out. He was stressed, you could hear it in his voice. You knew it was him. Besides just his voice, only controllers used the Charlie suffix. It's impossible to say what John felt on Taker Gar in the moment of realization that he was completely alone. Fear, surely, and pain and shock were already gripping his body. But determination must have compelled him. When he got no reply to his transmissions, he likely worked through the mechanics of his radio equipment one component at a time. The radio first, then his comm cord, connecting it to his headset. And finally, the earpiece and mic. He tried calling multiple times but must never have heard Jay's responses, for reasons unknown. He gave up on his radio for the moment. He was getting colder from blood loss. All he had warmed for warmth was a thin layer of black capelline liners for his legs, a lightweight green fleece top, and his desert camel pants and blouse. His feet were warm in wool socks and leather heavy-duty A-Solo hiking boots, and he had gray, loosely weaved fingerless gloves on his hands. But without body armor or a helmet, his torso and head were suffering from exposure. His PVS-15 NVGs were mounted on a padded bracket, universally referred to by the guys as the fucked-up head harness, which allowed the goggles to be worn without a helmet, but was uncomfortable and awkward with its pads and straps. His M-Biter was connected to a single-ear headset with a boom-type mic for speaking. To transmit, he merely needed to push a button with his index finger, and the programmed frequency would send the signal. Only now he was receiving no response. At least his M4 was working. That was critical. It had a reflex-style sight, as well as an AN PEC-2 laser, the same pointer Slab had seen moving just before the SEALs retreated, and a suppressor. Not that suppression mattered. It would provide no masking of his location at this range. Which raised a question. Did the Chechens and Uzbeks know he was here? As Chapman took stock of his situation, two Al-Qaeda fighters were moving upslope in his direction along the ridge below, but their sights were set on the SEALs sliding down the cliff face. They slowly encroached, attempting to gain a view of the Americans. If they could get over the top, they'd be able to strike at them. Slab and the other SEALs were still only 50 meters from Chapman, but he had been cast from their thoughts. Their focus was survival. Without the combat controller, Slab was forced to break out his M-Biter and work through the presets to find the fire direction net frequency. Turner, overhead in his gunship, had been watching the calamity unfold. Powerless to help and not able to reach Chapman or the team as the firefight in a phone booth unfolded 5,000 feet below. In the back of the AC-130, Staff Sergeant Chris Walker sat in the sensor booth, essentially a room built into the right side of a fuselage opposite the 25mm GAU-12 Gatling cannon, 40mm Bofors, and M-102 105mm howitzer. As the low-light-level TV operator, LLL-TV, he was responsible for illuminating targets covertly in the dark. The images could be amplified to produce a clear battlefield picture even without moonlight. He was joined by three others, the infrared IR system operator, an electronic warfare officer, and an observer. They sat in a claustrophobic row, together with both pilots and a fire control officer on the flight deck. They saw everything that happened on the ground below. When Slab raised Grim 3-2 on the radio, the aircrew was relieved to find someone, anyone, to talk to. Now they could get down to business, doing what no other fire support platform in the world could. Orbit a friendly force surrounded by hostiles and turn back the tide. The first thing Slab called for was the quick reaction force. With his request relayed, Slab turned his attention to the gunship's weapons, telling Turner, "We're kind of hiding on the edge of a little precipice. I know how to call for fire, and I know I'm danger close, but I'm telling you, I need the fire now." He went on to describe the peak. "There's no friendlies up top?" asked the leery pilot. Only 2 days earlier, Turner's gunship had been involved in the friendly fire incident with Blaber and Haas's convoy. He was not about to repeat history. The SEALs had by now turned on an IR strobe, which Walker clearly identified on his screen. Walker could also see the SEALs. "No," replied Slab. Neither he nor the gunship had any idea Chapman was now moving under the tree just below the summit. And Chapman, no longer on the fire direction frequency, had no idea he was now in greater peril from his compatriots than from Al-Qaeda. "I want guns on two big clusters of trees up there. Only two are up there near a big rock. You got the strobe?" Meaning his own location. "Yeah, I got the strobe." 30 seconds later, the gunship put several rounds down on the summit and asked the SEAL for corrections. but Slab had no means of observing where the rounds were impacting. With the SEALs unable to adjust their fire, the gunship was shooting blindly. Chapman, sheltering below the bonsai tree, remained crouched in the bunker as the mountain exploded around him. On the ridge above and just south of the SEALs, the two Al-Qaeda fighters continued stalking the Americans. Another fighter remained on the point of the rock fin, watching the two brothers. He was safer in his rock position, observing the events unfold. In the gunship, the co-pilot asked Slab, "Do you have anybody to your south?"
"No, I have all my guys. I have two or three guys moving to the south."
"They are not mine."
"Roger."
A 105mm howitzer round exploded on the rocky fin's farthermost point, destroying the rock outcropping and vaporizing the observer.
"They aren't moving anymore,"
came the gunship's simple assessment. The two stalkers, a mere 150 feet from the detonation, changed their minds, withdrew from the ridgeline, and moved into a small collection of rocks just below Razor 04's landing site. One of them, an Uzbek, had on Robert's desert camo Gore-Tex pants, which he'd rifled out of the dead SEAL's rucksack. The two were soon joined by another, who came up the draw by himself. There they discussed what should be done. The Americans may have retreated, but they still possessed immense firepower in the form of the AC-130 that could be heard droning relentlessly overhead. The summit was taking a pounding beyond bunkers 1 and 2, and the jihadists could do little during the onslaught but wait and pray to Allah. A few kilometers in the opposite direction, Combat Controller Ben Miller and Mako 2-1 were observing the chaos. With the obvious fight unfolding a scant distance away, they were anxious to get into it. Ben made repeated requests on their behalf, stating Mako 2-1 is about 7 clicks west of current situation, and able to assist if only headquarters can send a helo their way. Pete Blaber, now mobile in the valley below, monitoring a number of troops in contact, and with a clear view of the mountain, listened patiently. Eventually, he told the team, "Hold what you got." Al, the team leader, had to quell a near mutiny by the other SEALs, who felt their place was in the battle. "Blaber wouldn't let us leave our mountain." But Blaber knew the CSAR helicopter would be on its way, and it was impossible to generate another to move the men, who weren't equipped for a sustained gunfight the way Gabe, Carrie, Jason, and the Rangers were, with multiple heavy machine guns, ammunition, and grenades. Mako 2-1 was also not even close to its own objective, and was struggling in the frozen terrain. They'd already passed J-Team's resupply to the 101st for delivery instead of taking it themselves. With their own mission a long way off, they needed to focus. Footnote. As with Mako 3-0, SEAL Team 6 leadership rushed Mako 2-1 into the field, ill-prepared for their mission and leaving critical gear behind. Unbeknownst to AFO personnel and Gardez, they also established a separate line of communication with the TF Blue TOC in Bagram, asking to be pulled from the mission. Ultimately, they were extracted early without putting eyes on their objective or calling any airstrikes. A distressed Chapman repeatedly called out on his radio, each time heard 4 clicks away by Jay, who responded immediately every time. Chapman either never received the replies or couldn't hear them under the fire of the gunship. However, John must not have been monitoring the AC-130's fires net, or he would have made himself known to the aircraft. Jay was increasingly concerned for his friend. The gunship was churning up the mountain. On ROP, we were talking about what was happening on Taker Gar. Everyone agreed there were two elements on the mountain. You could hear Slab on the FDO, fire direction frequency, talking to Grimm, and Chapman was on either LOS or another freak. In his bunker, John continued to bleed. The pounding by the AC-130 was terrifying. And he knew, better than others, that if a 105 round hit his position, he'd be obliterated. Intermittently, he reached out to raise someone,
anyone on UHF without success. His attention was diverted by the enemy, who now knew he was there. Their intentions were announced by an RPG exploding against Bunker One's upper berm a few feet above his head, showering him with dirt. With a blast kill radius of several meters, he survived only because most of the detonation was deflected over his head, yet it still damaged his ears and left them ringing. Okay. They knew he was here. Ironically, it was likely the unwitting gunship and its rounds ravaging the summit that had prevented a rush by the Chechens and Uzbeks. To allay any doubt about their understanding of the situation, a grenade tossed from Bunker 2 exploded between the combatants. Using his PEC 2, John fired his weapon over the top of the berm and hunkered down lower, while the Al-Qaeda in Bunker 2 continued to pound his position repeatedly with AK-47 and PKM fire. Despite the gunship, the mountain was now populated across its upper slopes by additional fighters converging on the Americans. Here and there, pairs and singles of Al-Qaeda searched for targets. One of the fighters, the Uzbek who'd taken Robert's Gore-Tex pants, made a decision. It was obvious an American was in Bunker 1, a fortified position he himself had helped to build and occupy in preparation for the glorious battle he hoped to wage against the Americans. And now, one of the infidels had the audacity to occupy his mountain. He began to snake his way upslope at an oblique angle to Chapman's position, using the fire from Bunker 2 as a mask. Other Al-Qaeda knew the Americans were now split, with one group falling down the cliff face the jihadists had avoided, and at least one more in Bunker 1, where the only true firefight was raging on. It drew most of their attention to the beleaguered combat controller. As a consequence, it also drew most of the fire, alleviating the pressure on the wounded and retreating SEALs, who continued to slide down the mountain in order to gain distance from the enemy. On the Predator's camera, the unfolding violence was captured silently by its unblinking eye. John's world became an interminable one-man stand as he fired sparingly, trying to pace his ammo depletion. He was either already too weak from blood loss or thought better of exposing himself to throw any hand grenades. Whatever his reason, he used none of them. Mortars now rocked his position as well, as the jihadists on the lower slopes lobbed rounds onto the mountain, apparently unmoved by the potential fratricide this might produce. More alone than ever, and shaking from the cold and shock, John fought on. He had no choice. Either the SEALs would come back, a rescue force would arrive, or they would not, and he would fire until he was out of ammunition or killed. The SEALs were no longer firing, so they were either dead or had left the summit. Either way, he was alone in this battle. As he lay there in an enemy trench, the sun slowly crept toward the horizon, chasing the darkness from the mountain. Its deadly illumination was already snatching John's few remaining advantages by laying the pre-dawn twilight at Al-Qaeda's feet. He snapped his NVGs, now useless, up onto his fucking head harness. His watch read 0553, 20 minutes before true sunrise, but that hardly mattered. This high on the mountain, it was already light enough to see. For everyone to see. Overhead, Chris Walker continued to watch the events unfold. Next to him, Gordon Bauer, as the infrared sensor operator, was working Grim 32's IR system to target the enemy for the pilots. The AR-130H IR system did not pick up infrared strobes like the one John had now activated. Rather, the plane's IR system registered heat signatures only, so that anything warmer than the surrounding terrain appeared as a black outline. The two sensor operators frequently compared inputs to events on the ground, allowing them to form a comprehensive picture. As Walker recalled in his witness statement, indications of friendly engagement from within Bunker 1 against the enemy were frequent and consistent. I continued to observe glint tape, strobe lights, muzzle flashes, and ISLID laser movement after 0042 Zebra, the GMT time at which the SEALs retreated from the summit, from Bunker 1. Those innocuous and sanitized observations failed to convey the carnage on the ground. John Chapman was fighting for his life and losing the battle. He was now marred by shrapnel in his arms and body, his misery compounded by growing weakness as the bleeding in his abdomen continued.
Any station, this is Mako 03 Charlie.
He tried again in vain. Jay Hill heard the call and responded for the dozenth time, but his transmission never reached John's ear. A fusillade from Bunker 2, including yet another RPG, seized John's attention. This was followed by an Al-Qaeda flanker from his right, across the slope, and from below Bunker 2. John quickly dispatched the threat with a few well-aimed shots. There was no time to regroup in his isolated bunker. Without warning, the Uzbek and Robert's desert Gore-Tex pants, dyed henna beard, and green Russian camo charged him from the boulder above Bunker 1, firing as he rushed over Robert's dead body. Fortunately, Gore-Tex pants was struggling to make ground on John as quickly as he hoped. He was wearing slip-on shoes with no tread, and his progress was slowed by the lack of traction. Still, he was only feet away and firing point-blank at the American. John swung his M4, and from a distance of a mere 10 feet, felled the Uzbek with several precious rounds to the chest. The Uzbek dropped like a rock onto his back into a twisted final pose, never to rise again, his lifeless eyes staring skyward. The time was exactly 0600. John was breathing heavily now, the pain pushed back by true fight-or-flight adrenaline, but by no means eliminated. Two rushers attacked in as many minutes. He was now going through ammunition at an alarming pace. Of the 7 30-round magazines he started with, he was down to only a couple. And unlike the SEALs, he had no pistol secondary. A lull arrived like a double-edged blessing. True, no one was shooting at him for the moment. But huddled in the bottom of the dirty, narrow trench, surrounded by frozen, bloody snow and dead bodies, John was now more alone than ever. Seconds felt like minutes. Time stretched, the pain dragging it out. An eternity. With no options, he waited. 4 minutes passed. He tried another unsuccessful radio call. How many did that make? He'd lost count. The threats all seemed to come from above and his left and right, certainly the heavy machine gun fire. What John didn't realize was, while the first flanker charged from the right, and Gore-Tex pants had been approaching from the left in preparation for his own assault, another lone gunman was making his way upslope. Silently, the stalker advanced. Seeing his two brothers fall to the man in the bunker, he decided another rush assault was inadvisable. Clearly, the American, armed with an M4 by the sound of its report, was deadly with his weapon. Stealth was called for. Sporadic fire from Bunker 2 directed at Bunker 1 assisted in masking his approach and keeping the American's attention. And so the man pushed forward. At 0606, the lone gunman arrived below Bunker 1, in precisely the location the SEALs had occupied just before leaving Chapman behind. Who struck first will remain forever unknown. But John engaged the gunman in fierce hand-to-hand combat, his already shrapnel-ridden and bleeding body drastically diminished. The gunman connected with the controller at least a few times, leaving blunt force injuries of the head, neck, and extremities, a contused forehead, and abrasions of the lips, nose, and cheeks, as noted in the official forensic pathology report. Somehow, the severely injured Chapman overwhelmed his attacker and killed him, leaving the body at the mouth of the bunker. Exhausted and hyped up on another rush of adrenaline, he had no time to recover. Bunker 2 launched an even more ferocious attack, firing one more RPG into Chapman's redoubt. Footnote. Attempts to claim that Bunker 1 is not occupied by the live Chapman are refuted by the fact that only those in Bunker 2 could have occupied Bunker 1. Only Gore-Tex Pants and the lone stalker from below came from elsewhere. Also, Bunker 2 had been attacking Bunker 1 repeatedly. Since that is the case, even if Gore-Tex Pants charging to hand-to-hand distance is a mistake, and then 6 minutes later the lone gunman does the same, the follow-on firefight that ensues, again between the two bunkers, is otherwise inexplicable. They'd know if it was fellow Al-Qaeda at this point, having seen them, and because they originally sent the forces to take the bunker in the form of the first flanker. Finally, it is now daylight. Chapman heard the MH-47's heavy rotors beating the cold, clear air in the early morning twilight. He may have even seen the helicopter's approach, though whether he did or not was immaterial. There was only one place the rotor sound of a laden MH-47 laboring up the mountain slopes would be headed. Take Her Gar. A wave of relief surely washed over him as he realized that either Slab, their insertion helo, or headquarters must have initiated the QRF. They were coming back for him. Another reality. With no one else to defend the HLZ, this MH-47 would meet the same fate as the previous two. Though he couldn't have known, this helo was stuffed with Rangers, two Air Force PJs, and fellow combat controller Gabe Brown. All totaled 18 men. The loss of life, should it fall victim to a fully alerted and prepared enemy with multiple RPG firing positions and heavy weapons, would be catastrophic. The worst in the war to date. Chapman knew what the enemy wanted. His fighting position, Bunker 1, had a clear view of the helicopter's approach and a direct line of fire where it would set down. As things stood from their positions higher on the mountain, the enemy couldn't engage the rescue team. They needed his position to place their RPGs. If the Rangers made it to the hilltop intact, the roles would reverse, and Al-Qaeda would be the ones in danger of being overrun, not Chapman. His options were nil. To save the lives of the rescue force sent to save his own, he needed to negate the threat, just as he had done an hour before, saving the lives of his entire SEAL team. If he was to survive, he'd need to somehow climb out of the bunker, battered, bleeding, and severely wounded, and take the fight to the enemy, challenging the jaws of death once more. Remaining static would surely be his demise. He had one weapon and little ammo, but the course of action was clear. John's commitment to his comrades was clearly evident that morning, and it necessitated rising from the bunker to save the men he didn't know on Razor 01. His actions can be best summed up in a word: brotherhood. And to men in combat, brotherhood is love. There's no difference between the two words. While it's impossible to say if the thought crossed his mind, or even if he recognized it at all in that short moment, his decision to act at this point was surely the embodiment of those two interchangeable words. At 06:11, with a glorious sunrise striking his east-facing bunker, John Chapman, face battered and bloodied, his body racked with pain, made the bravest decision of his life. He mounted the shrapnel-spattered berm onto the dirty and blood-stained snow, blinking against the blinding rays of the morning sun. If the Chechens and Uzbeks had any question as to whether the lone American was still alive, he answered them with his first volley, a multi-round burst aimed directly at their PKM, his ejected casings glinting in the morning sunlight as they launched skyward. He emptied the magazine in his M4, then switched mags before dropping prone in the snow in the face of the PKM's response. A barrage was unleashed on Bunker 1 as Al-Qaeda fighters saw the loaded MH-47 making its final approach, seconds from landing. On the far side of the summit, a lone RPG gunner moved into position,
while a second RPG warhead was mounted on a launcher inside Bunker 2. Elsewhere across the slopes, fighters continued to converge. Another flank attempt was made from the east. John slid down the slope on his side with his legs in front of him, stopping just below his bunker and the bonsai tree. With a fresh magazine, he engaged and killed the eastern flanker. But there was absolutely no time to stay in the relative safety of the defilade below the tree. Struggling up the rocky, snow-covered bank, he turned his adrenaline on the PKM again, firing as he moved, until more AK-47 rounds assaulted him from the east. Staring into the blazing sunlight, he searched for targets, firing rounds in desperation to protect the helicopter, now throwing snow from its rotor wash, and drowning out the noise of enemy gunfire with the thumping of its mighty turbine engines. John leaned his haggard body against the giant bonsai, using it for protection, methodically engaging any movement on the mountain. There were just too many targets for one man. More fighters appeared to the south along the ridge like ants from an anthill. The unmistakable sound of an exploding RPG warhead stopped time. Behind John, the giant MH-47 reeled under the impact of a direct hit as the grenade exploded against its right engine, destroying it instantly. The left engine immediately compensated for the loss of power by revving. It was no use. Overloaded and at high altitude, its fate was sealed. The co-pilot had already been shot in the leg and helmet. Calvert, the pilot, considered making a single-engine descent from the summit, but realized he'd never clear the ridge in front of him. He immediately dropped the helo down expertly with a thump. As the Chinook settled onto the slope, John resumed engaging the Al-Qaeda fighters. Dropping prone again, he fired at the most immediate threat to the devastated helicopter, which had yet to disgorge any soldiers or airmen. The fighters along the ridge enjoyed a broadside view of the bird and immediately set about raking it with heavy fire, including more RPGs, killing several Rangers and crew.